Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. November 17th, 2022, the SBF, FTX, WTF edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast in Washington, D.C. John Dickerson of CBS Primetime is with us in New York as ever. Hello, John.
Hello, David. I gave your title a hearty chuckle.
Thank you. And not chuckling, dourly staring down, is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. Not dourly. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David. Just, you know, looking up some good fresh cocktail chatter.
This week on the Gabfest, Donald Trump announces his 2024 campaign for president. Then a lot of us, like me, took solace in the fact that so many election deniers lost last week. Why did that happen? What does it portend for American democracy? Then the collapse of Sam Bankman-Fried's crypto empire. We will talk to Matt Zeitlin of Grid about it and what it means for the effective altruism movement, the very interesting effective altruism movement. Plus, of course, we'll have cocktail chatter. And listeners, it is conundrum time. Please send us your conundrums for our annual Gabfest conundrum show. Go to slate.com/conundrums. We would love some amazing ones. Like if you were going to spend $1 billion to do the best thing you could do for the world over the long term, but that $1 billion didn't really exist and was in crypto, what would you spend it on? Or if you were trying to hide an elephant, how would you do it? What's a favorite conundrum of yours from years past, John?
There was a period where we had some kind of really dark ones, the old throw a switch, you know, Hitler's baby ones. Those I don't like. So that's not an answer to your question.
Hitler had no babies.
I can't remember what.
Would you rather be a dragon or have a dragon? That's a good one. Anyway, slate.com/conundrums. Submit yours. You have better ones than we do. Can't wait to talk about them.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
In a rambling and pretty dull announcement at Mar-a-Lago on Tuesday, Donald Trump declared that he is running for president in 2024.
Together, we will be taking on the most corrupt forces and entrenched interests imaginable. Our country is in a horrible state. We're in grave trouble. This is not a task for a politician or a conventional candidate. This is a task for a great movement that embodies the courage, confidence, and the spirit of the American people. This is a movement. This is not for any one individual.
He announced this early over the wishes of basically everyone, Republican at least, on the planet, who wanted him to stay out of sight until after the Georgia Senate runoff in early December, with the mendacity and nastiness and self-pity that characterizes Trump. He took credit for various things he did not deserve credit for, blamed Biden and Democrats for problems they do not deserve blame for, and felt really sorry for himself. Emily, there is a sense with Trump that he is at once the dominant player in the Republican Party and yet also somehow done. How can both of those things be true?
He's the dominant player because so many Republican voters are loyal to him and there's no sign of peeling them away. But it also seems like he's done because his obsessions helped the party underperform expectations in the midterm. And I think this focus on his 2020 grievances is like the central tenet of who he is and his performance as president as being what should be front and central, you know, all his enemies, all his whipping children. It just is not a good, I think the party leaders more and more conclude that this is going to be a huge liability going forward. It's so past focused, right? I mean, that just seems itself like a problem. Is that, John, do you think that's part of what's happening here?
Yes and no. Yes, he feels very much like a man of the past. Yes, Republicans would like to frame him as a man of the past because that allows them to sort their ultimate break with him into a traditional structure, which is a part of the larger goal for a lot of Republicans who enabled him, sucked up to him, rose in their own lives as a result of the world he created, but they don't want to wrestle with all of those climb downs of their own personal character. They would like to just relegate him. Oh, he's yesterday's man. Now we're going to move on, because we relegate, you know, politics is forward looking, not in the past. We're ready for the new world, not the past. That's like, that makes him sound like he's any old political figure and not a person who they supported despite essentially trying to destroy the presidency and the Constitution. And so I think it is absolutely true that he feels like yesterday's man, but I think it's crucial not to avoid the reckoning, and I'm not suggesting at all this is what you're doing in framing it that way, Emily, but not to avoid the reckoning of what happened when an entire political party decided that all of the rules of the presidency and the American Constitution were malleable like a balloon animal for the maintenance of power, and essentially he became a loser once he became a loser. In other words, if he were still a winner, all those excuses would still be in play now that he picked some bad candidates. And we should talk about what that means, because people voted for those candidates. So suddenly Donald Trump's getting blamed for them. But what about all the voters who picked all those candidates in primaries? Are you essentially saying that they can't think for themselves? And that's a weird position to be in. As a Republican Party.
But, you know, in some sense, John, listening to you, I mean, of course, I think that reckoning is really important. And it strikes me that the focus on Trump means that the Republican Party is sort of wallowing in us talking about that reckoning, right? Like, if they moved on from him, they could slip the noose of some of that discussion being front and center. And instead, that's the problem with Trump. Like, he forces them right back into it.
Well, or his last great act to the Republican Party may be as a sink for all of the embarrassment those who traded away their character and their belief in the norms of a functioning constitutional republic. They can just basically say, oh, well, we're done with Donald Trump and we're moving on, and make him basically the scapegoat for the losses, for the era of Trump. And not have to wrestle with their role in that era. I think, as you quite rightly point out, he's not going to go gently into that good Mar-a-Lago. I mean, he has, and I think that there's probably some great character from literature of the, you know, the wounded dying giant who nevertheless sweeps his paw across the land and takes out a lot of people.
I have this fantasia that Republicans are going to try to be nicer. I overvalue civility in politics, but it feels like to me the outsider position, the position, the space to seize in 2024 is happy warrior, not angry warrior. That is where the Republicans are going to ultimately end up. I could be completely wrong. It could be that this kind of this boiling, festering kind of pussy animus that has animated so many of Trump's supporters persists. But I have this hope that maybe that's a space that will be different and new.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that would be a successful general election strategy. I have trouble imagining how someone makes it through the primaries with that, because the whole appeal is anger and loss of the culture wars and demonizing other groups, right?
So, but is it? I mean, is that what that is? That
well,
what,
tell me what it is otherwise.
That what people,
what's the lane?
I don't know that Brian Kemp in Georgia is that's how he wins. I don't know that that's how people are winning in every state.
Kemp
won
is like a manager.
We see that a
lot
of people who ran that way lost.
This is the key question for the party. I think so. The happy warrior is sort of Jack Kemp, Ronald Reagan. Who is that? The best I can come up with is and is like Mike DeWine, who's not really even. And it, we should. It's interesting if you look at DeWine and DeSantis, two huge winners in red states. DeWine won by more than DeSantis. And DeSantis is getting all the love. Why? Because he has that, you know, his whole anti-woke, this is the place woke comes to die. So even people like Senator Cassidy of Louisiana, who is trying to position himself as an ideas man in the Senate, says, you know, we've won with voters on the woke issue, which is, of course, him signaling sort of affirmation for DeSantis's approach. If you were truly an ideas guy, you would be on Mike DeWine's team, because DeWine's not really doesn't lead with the culture wars. DeSantis very, very, very successfully did, and is probably more, if you wanted a pure winning strategy for Republican politics, you'd line up behind DeWine, which I think is the answer to your question, David, about whether the party could switch to a happy warrior.
What do the next 6 months of this non-campaign look like? Does it even matter that Trump is running? It's not like he's going to be hanging out in Iowa diners late on a Wednesday night. What does it even mean that he is now a candidate?
I guess it means chaos. It means bad things possibly for the Georgia runoff. It means those other candidates who could have padded around in the shallow end probably have to step up. That's DeSantis, Youngkin, any of the senators who are thinking about running. Now, as I say that, maybe I'm totally wrong. Maybe you let him burn out and don't bother because you don't want to be the first one he attacks.
I mean, I think the other thing that Trump's candidacy means is it complicates things for the Justice Department with all these investigations. And it means that Trump won't be fact-checked on Facebook, for example. It has like that sort of ripple effect. Can I ask some questions about the challenge to McConnell's leadership, which I realize is a swerve, but I'm just really curious. I don't understand this Rick Scott challenge. Like, I don't get, he's like the person who could be blamed for some of the losses in the midterm since he was in charge of the financing arm, right? And like, why him? I don't understand this.
Well, I think if you've put your finger on something, a great point, which is kind of what we've been talking about, which is what is the theory of the case for the various groups of Republicans who would like to construct a post-Trump party? Scott made the point I was just making, which is when you say that these are bad candidates and it's poor candidate selection, which is undoubtedly true, you are saying something about the Republican voters. And if you're saying that the Republican voters in the primaries are so in Donald Trump's thrall that they picked these obviously awful candidates, then the January 6th committee would like to thank you for submitting a brief on behalf of their argument, which is that Donald Trump's supporters are so in his thrall that when he says something, they storm the Capitol and that he's to blame for that. So if you're going to blame Trump for these bad candidates, then the transitive property follows of January 6th. But anyway, that's a slightly obscure point. Back to yours, Emily, which is Scott was responsible for that. And his argument for beating McConnell was, well, we should have run on specifics. I don't think anybody would have argued that in given the economy as bad as it was and Biden's approval ratings as bad as they were, that you should talk about cutting Social Security while that's going on. I mean, it's pretty basic that you just let the other team have their bad record and let the midterms be a referendum on them. The reason it wasn't in this case is because Donald Trump and abortion. And Scott is on the side of those things that most people think helped Democrats survive in this last election. So it is a real head scratcher. It's probably why he only got 10 votes in the challenge to McConnell, which he lost.
Emily, it feels like Fox may not be the useful megaphone, the useful trumpet for Trump that it was last time. If that continues, how important do you think that is for whether he can remain the front runner?
I think it's really important. You also see some of the Rupert Murdoch-owned print properties turning, like the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal. The reason I think this is important goes back to John's question earlier about what Trump has on various Republican leaders and officials who try to turn away from him, which is my theory of Trump is that he is the classic bully, and the only way you defeat a bully is a united front. Everyone has to link arms and say no together, and then you can't pick them off one by one, which he's a total master at doing. So if you have the, you know, Fox, particularly, I think, Hannity and Tucker Carlson willing to separate themselves from him, oh, and also that Fox and Friends show, then he doesn't have easy ways to strike back that are getting to the meat of the voters, right? Like the place where they live. And that seems to me like it could matter as part of the United Front if it emerges.
Slate Plus members get bonus segments on the Gabfest and other Slate podcasts, member exclusive episodes from some shows like Slow Burn and Amicus. There are no ads on any Slate podcast if you're a Slate Plus member. Unlimited reading on the Slate site if you're a Slate Plus member. And our bonus segment for Slate Plus is going to be a Thanksgiving one. You know how much we love Thanksgiving here at the GabFest. So we're going to talk about what Thanksgiving activity should be abolished or moved to a different time of the year. Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. This episode of the GabFest is sponsored by Aura Frames. Are you ready to win Mother's Day? Cement your reputation as the best gift giver in your family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. That mom will love looking back on childhood memories, seeing you what you're up to today, checking out grandkids, checking out cousins. And even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep on updating your mom's frame with new photos so that it's the gift that keeps on giving. This is how I live in my family. I gave my mother an Aura frame. It was either for Mother's Day or for her birthday. She absolutely adores it. She's constantly hectoring me to update it with more photos, which I do. I also gave my girlfriend's mother an Aura frame, and I hope she hectors my girlfriend to update it with more photos. But it is a present that will bring absolute delight to a mother in your life. And they have a great deal for Mother's Day. GabFest listeners can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Candidates who built their campaigns around the idea that the 2020 election was stolen and that American elections are extremely corrupt did so badly last week. Huh, how satisfying. They ran well behind Republicans who didn't really talk about the 2020 election, and they lost almost all the key races they were in, especially the key Secretary of State races, and notably mostly in Arizona and Michigan, where there were a ton of folks like this. So, Emily, you have been following this a ton. How much can we attribute these losses to the fact that candidates align themselves with focusing on the 2020 election and discrediting the American voting mechanisms?
I mean, I think it's striking that they were running behind other Republicans. People were doing some ticket splitting to vote against them. And that seems significant to me in terms of a signal going forward about, you know, whether you really want to run for Secretary of State by trying to say that the whole system is corrupt, because I think people understand, or at least enough Americans in key states seem to understand, that if you put the election administration in the hands of someone who essentially has fallen for a conspiracy theory, that that is not going to do well by your state. So I think it's really important. And in some ways, I found these down ballot races, especially for Secretary of State, to be the most reassuring part of the returns, because, you know, forget partisanship here. There just should be this basic commitment to the functioning of democracy. And people who were disavowing that and threatening that seem to pay a price.
And also not to elect people who are just daffy.
Yes.
Because it was not just that they were saying, elect me to be the wolf in charge of the chicken coop, but like the ability to reason. I mean, some of it was shrewd calculation, but some of them were witless.
Does this mean, John, that election subversion is no longer a threat?
No, I think that one of the things that will be worth watching if there is a post Donald Trump era is what and how much you're allowed to flirt with these ideas for the purposes of helping yourself. I think it seems what Emily said is right, which is that saying that the election is rigged turns out to be a turnout mechanism for Democrats and suppresses the vote for the conspiracy theorists, because some people at some level decide, well, it doesn't. I would vote for the Republican here, but it's all rigged, so I'm not going to show up. So that seems to have been shooting oneself in the foot. But the ability to raise money and get a crowd to roar by saying that the other side is full of illegal immigrants who are somehow getting on the rolls and full of people who aren't like us who are sneaking on the rolls and all of that, that incentive is still very much there. I mean, we shouldn't forget that Ron DeSantis, who is defining perhaps the post-Trump era, has used that effectively, and that this has been that the idea of going after voter fraud has been a part of the playbook at one amplitude or another for a very long time, and no doubt will continue to be, although being only that seems to be not successful.
I mean, it's also important to watch the space for Moore versus Harper, which is the Supreme Court case, which will be argued on December 7th and presumably decided in June. That's about, you know, this theory of independent state legislatures being the only entities that should, in the view of some people, I think, bent on election subversion, being the only entity that can regulate elections, especially federal elections. That would be a huge shift in American law. The other thing is, we're not quite done with Maricopa County yet. I mean, Carrie Lake, I don't think, as of our taping, has conceded, and there's some lawsuit brewing there. What interests me about that situation is that Trump didn't dive into the middle of it, right? I mean, if he had gone there the day after the election and started beating the drum for, you know, this election was stolen from Lake, that could have really gotten some media attention at least and seemed more threatening.
He doesn't care, it's not him, this is
his narcissism just super evident, but in this case usefully so.
Why do you think there hasn't been litigation? There was so much litigation in 2020, and all these folks were saying, you know, hinting, or they wouldn't accept results, and yet so far, except for this ambiguous situation around Lake, the losers have not challenged the results.
Well, I think unless you have Trump really feeding this, it turns out that, look, I mean, to make out a credible lawsuit, you're supposed to be able to show that there was some evidence of fraud that was great enough to have determined the result. A lot of these results were not actually very close. And so that's important in itself, right? That you just don't have the number of votes in play that could plausibly change the outcome. And then I think you have these candidates who actually, like, in the end were shying away from this, you know, door that Trump had opened, with the exception of Lake, because there is going to be some litigation in Maricopa County.
John, how much do you think the candidate choice and the focus on election subversion or a focus on election denying was MAGA echo chamber stupidity, where conservative media just amplified something people thought it really was a winning issue, and they just didn't listen to all the people outside of their echo chamber who were being skeptical, and therefore they made a huge mistake, where if they had just run regular candidates, they would have done so much better.
It's a really, really interesting question to which I don't have a clear answer. I mean, you had basically, I think as Jonathan Chait put it, there were two positions. One was the election was stolen, and these are two positions that Republican candidates took. The election was stolen, and when they were asked about the election, the response would be, murmur, murmur, murmur. So that instead of doing the honorable thing and the lowest possible bar you could clear, which is to say that the American Institution of Elections operated fairly and that Joe Biden is the duly elected president, because that's a system in which you hope to succeed because you're running for office, and that a system that gives people power based on the trust in elections can't function when you're constantly pouring poison into that system. Nevertheless, some people refuse to clear that very low bar for honorable behavior in public life. So that is still kind of astonishing to me.
I have another part of this theory, which is I think there was just a lot of energy and friction around this. So if you were within the Republican Party, the people who were showing up and trying to throw the bastards out and seemed like they cared a great deal, right? And so in that moment of the primaries or the internal party dynamics of who the local people were going to be pulling the strings, that just generated a lot of heat. And so those candidates seemed like they were exciting, even if they really didn't have a prayer of winning in a general election. So I'm thinking of that, I thought, really excellent This American Life episode that Zoe Chace and Isaac Arnsdorf did about Arizona and control of the local organs of the Republican Party there.
And why bum out people who are so energized if you don't have to, which is what leads to the mumbling? And also, there was a huge other set of issues that Republicans, not wrongly, thought would be more important. And that is the economy and inflation and crime in some places. And basically, if you don't antagonize your own side by needlessly poking the Donald Trump supporters who think the election was stolen, and you can stay quiet on that, then you can allow these other issues to rampage, which are going to lead all of you to success. And that also seems probably to have been in the end, they were wrong, but they weren't. That wasn't a crazy place to be in if you're a Republican politician. Morally, you already know my position, but as just a sheer political move, probably the smart place to be.
It's important to remember that there are still some election-related challenges going on in the courts that could have legs. So in Pennsylvania, there are all these questions about counting absentee ballots, which the state Supreme Court ended up taking a pretty narrow view of, you know, this idea that if there are technical glitches on your envelope or your ballot, they're not going to get counted. As I understand it, there's much less opportunity to cure the ballot than there is in some other states, even, for example, in Georgia. That's just, it seems narrow, but, you know, in a very close election, it could matter a great deal. Similarly, the fight over drop boxes in Wisconsin is something that could still affect the 2024 election. And when you look at the lawyers who are litigating some of those cases, they're more traditional Republicans. So you see Don McGahn involved in this, the law firm Jones Day. That's been a kind of adjacent lane to the really like bananas stuff that was happening. And we're going to absolutely continue to see that.
As you know, GabFest listeners, we now do a bonus episode every month called GabFest Reads, where one of us reads a book that we're excited about and talks to the author. And this month, on November 19th, this weekend, we have such an exciting GabFest Reads. What is it, Dr. Emily Bazelon, JD?
It is my friend Beverly Gage's book, G-Man, which is this amazing monumental biography of J. Edgar Hoover that Bev has been working on for so long. And that is both really strong narrative and also a fascinating portrayal of much of 20th century American history. I'm going to brag one more brag for Bev, which is she's gotten excellent reviews in The New Yorker and The Washington Post. And I had such a great time. I'm talking with her about this book.
I got a notice that I had a package yesterday and I was like, oh, it's my pre-ordered G-Man. And it was not. It was kitty litter.
Not to be. I have the feeling that this is, was it Ronald Steele who wrote that great book about Walter Lippmann? I think it was. Anyway, you saw the entire 20th century through Walter Lippmann. And I feel like this book is going to be like that.
It is a really wonderful book. I think it does serve that function.
Listen to GabFest Reads this weekend in your GabFest feed. Emily had to step out for this next segment, but she will be back for Cocktail Chatter. The saga of Sam Bankman-Fried, the tycoon and would-be philanthropist whose crypto companies FTX and Alameda Research exploded and went bankrupt, is absolutely enthralling across a bunch of levels. First is a fascinating story. It's about the fragility of the crypto economy, whether the entire crypto ecosystem is built on sand. Second, it's a drama about regulation and whether government can successfully regulate an industry that's so chaotic and untethered to actual place. Third, Bankman-Fried, SBF, was a huge Democratic donor and was promising to give a lot more, and his vaporization will have repercussions for American politics. And fourth, and maybe most interestingly, SBF was the public face, or a public face, of the effective altruism movement, which, to oversimplify it terribly, kind of encompasses two ideas. First, that people should seek to earn enormous amounts of money by whatever means they can so they can apply it to solve the world's problems. And second, at least in the kind of school of thought that SBF represents, they should focus on solving long-term problems, big long-term problems. So we're talking today to Matt Zeitlin of GRID, who has written really interestingly about what could happen to effective altruism amid the wreckage of SBF's empire. Hello, Matt. Welcome to the GabFest.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So let's start. What is effective altruism? What kind of problems was SBF and the people he was funding trying to solve?
So Sam Bankman-Fried is an interesting figure because he represents a lot of, he's kind of a stand-in for a lot of what's happened to the movement recently, where there's kind of these two big ideas. One you can kind of call like EA 1.0 and one you can call EA 2.0.
Very webby of you to use those terms.
Yeah, these are my terms, but I think they're appropriate. I would say kind of the first wave of effective altruism, which kind of starts in the mid 2000s, early 2010s, is this idea that, you know, charitable giving should be larger and more optimized, and that people with large incomes in the Western world could make the world a lot better place by even giving a small, like even 10% of them every year to maximally effective charities. And this oftentimes cashed out in things like direct aid to very poor people, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, and public health projects, like distributing bed nets to prevent malaria and like deworming medication, often again in sub-Saharan Africa. What happens though in the late 2000s and 2010s is that some people in this movement become convinced by some philosophers at Oxford that that this basic framework is correct, donating is good, impact is important, but that the actual biggest problems in the world are things that could risk human extinction. And this oftentimes plays out in two ways. One is uncontrolled pandemics, often through some kind of malicious bioengineering, is something they've been very worried about for a long time. And the second is runaway artificial intelligence, where artificial intelligence becomes so smart and so capable, it starts reproducing itself rapidly, and because it's not properly aligned, as the kind of term of art they use, it can destroy the entire world. And what's interesting is that many people in the movement started out as the first type and now are the second type.
Do you think that EA is damaged by SBF's screw-ups? I'm just going to only use acronyms today.
I would say it's damaged in two ways. One is the most obvious, a huge pot of money they were counting on. SBF at some point started talking about he was going to start donating $1 billion a year to philanthropic projects. And it seems like in the last year or so, he had donated over $100 million. Like, that's just gone. That's a pot of money that no longer exists. This spring, Will McCaskill, who is an advisor at the FTX Future Fund and a friend of Sam Bankman-Fried's and arguably the person who inspired him to embrace this earning to give philosophy, he wrote a post in this popular forum for EAs saying that the EA funding situation had radically changed this past spring because of the amount of money FTX was bringing into the pot. So that money is gone. And that's a huge issue. And people right now, and some of my reporting talked about this, are scrambling, trying to replace those funds, wondering what's going to happen, going to other EAs with slightly different philosophies and asking for the money, which may be unsuccessful. The second thing, which I think is kind of more interesting and more speculative, is that Sam Bankman-Fried is very explicit about how his attitude towards risk and reward governed how he operated financially, which we now know to kind of be the case and kind of the downside. And two, were heavily influenced by EA ideas about the utility of money. So I would say intellectually, this is like, and people in the community are doing this, it's causing a huge rethinking about, you know, both kind of organizationally, what it means to have one person control so much money in a given, you know, field. And two, I think some rethinking about these attitude towards maximization and optimization that he very much at least said he embraced, and I think could be tied to his downfall.
And just to flesh that a little bit. I think what you're getting at is a sort of this, the coin flip theory, like take risk, because each time you take this risk and you have this huge upside, if you can generate massive amounts of money, that's the upside good that you can do with that massive amount of money is enormous. And the potential loss is just you have, you know, all right, you're back to zero and you can restart. It's not a big deal. And so, like, why wait at a billion? Get to two. Why wait at two? Get to 10. Get to 100. And at each point, you're increasing the amount of risk. And I guess I didn't see the consequences that vaporizing that money has on actual human beings and also actual people's trust in institutions and people's faith in that things work. And so if you actually, it's not that we've lost $16 billion, it's that people have now have lost an enormous amount of trust in institutions, faith in something, and that is hugely destructive. It's not just the loss of the money, it's actually a destruction of something bigger than the money.
Yeah, I think an important aspect here is that not only was Sam Bankman-Fried influenced by EA ideas, he's at its very heart like a trader, a financial trader. The firm he worked at right out of college when he kind of was embracing the earn-to-give philosophy is called Jane Street. And they don't make crazy one-directional bets on cryptocurrencies, like the stuff that they are alleged to have been doing and probably is what led to them losing all this money. But just they just have a very kind of traitoristic attitude towards risk, and that like you just quantify things and kind of roll with it. And I think that's very much he took a version of that attitude to a very extreme place and was very, very open about it, which I think is interesting. I think what the EA community has to think about is like the big debate over Bankman-Fried was like whether crypto exchanges were like bad for the world on their own, which I think is a very reasonable debate to have. I think the other thing is that did they really understand the business he was in and the types of risks he was taking, or they kind of think about this in a more, you know, theoretical way? And so I think that's a big question a lot of people are asking.
And were there incentives to not poke and or think too clearly or closely about what he was actually doing, right? Because if the money's rolling in.
I think in EA's defense, you know, like supposedly sophisticated investors and counterparties, like, you know, they're the ones receiving the money. It's the people giving him money that should be more skeptical of what's going on. So that's, you know, the Sequoias of the world, the big VC firms and the big investors that use this platform and borrowed money from him or lent him money. But yeah, you know, it's just like, it's what happens when you take these ideas about risk too seriously, I think is a real question.
How do you read Sam Bankman-Fried's interview after all this went down and what he says about his altruism and how that might affect this whole movement?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's not, he doesn't exactly say that EA was kind of a front for money making. I think he's more saying it's like good, it was good for him and to kind of have a good reputation, which I think is almost kind of axiomatically the case. And I also, and, you know, again, this is like pure speculation, but like I think it's oftentimes tempting when you're in a situation where you've kind of lost everything to kind of regain control over it and be like, you guys are the idiots for trusting me, which is not something he directly said but kind of implies. And it's, so again, we're gonna wait to see. And like his record of truth telling has been, you know, spotty to say the least, and to think just now he's being super honest, I think would be kind of be a leap of faith, but we'll see.
Read Matthew Zeitlin's article in Grid about Sam Bankman-Fried and effective altruism. Matt, thanks so much for coming and talking about this with us.
Thanks so much. I had a great time.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are being effectively altruistic and sharing a drink with somebody else, what are you going to be chattering about, John Dickerson?
Well, the first thing is that viewers who listen to this on Thursday should check out friend of the show, Stephen Colbert's Celebrity Pickleball show, Pickled, which is airing on CBS on Thursday night at 9 o'clock Eastern, 11 o'clock
Pacific. Is
that a joke?
There's no Celebrity Pickleball show now?
No. It's not. And
it cannot be a joke because pickleball is taking over the world.
Oh my God. It's totally taking over the world. And from what I've seen of it, it is très amusant. So check that out. I'm sure it'll also be available on Paramount Plus after it airs on Thursday night. And all the money that they raise for Pickled goes to charity. So anyway, that's the one thing. The other thing I learned is that, did you know that crossword puzzles started, first of all, it was called Word Cross. And second of all, it was started, newspapers started them in during the First World War to basically provide readers with something to keep them from being constantly bummed out by the war to end all wars, which I didn't know, A. And B, it was kind of funny to think of crosswords, which are so much a part of our life, as having their sort of Wordle moment, you know, where everybody is going around saying, did you hear about this thing called Word Cross? No, it's called crossword. Which is it? Oh, my God, where do I find it? And, you know, because I was interested in crosswords because there was this new study that was done about help with what it can and can't do for your brain health relative to those computer games you're always being served on various things. And turns out crosswords are better for your brain if you're trying to keep your brain agile into old age. Anyway, the other thing, this is a total hodgepodge chatter, but did you know that Mike Tyson is teaming up with Evander Holyfield to launch a line of cannabis? And he says, Tyson, who bit Holyfield's ear in 1997, as you may remember, said, if I was on cannabis, I wouldn't have bit his ear.
Might be so, true.
Yeah, could be true. Anyway.
Pitch, I think, actually.
That's, yeah, you're right. Okay,
John well, definitely feels like he's at a cocktail party. He's very.
He does.
He's just rolling along.
And a shout out to Andrea, GabFest listener, who said hello to me the other night in New York. Thanks for listening, and to apparently your whole family that listens as well. Those are my, that's my hodgepodge. I'll shut up now.
Emily, what's your chatter?
My chatter is distressing. It's it's about a few recent rulings by a judge, a federal judge, a Trump appointee named David Counts in the Western District of Texas about a very broad Second Amendment right to bear arms that, in the view of this judge, precludes people who've been accused of domestic violence and other kinds of serious allegations from having their guns taken from them. So the latest example of this was someone who was under a protective order and was found with a gun. This judge thinks that that person under the Second Amendment has the right to have a gun. He had also made a similar ruling about people who were being prosecuted but hadn't yet been convicted. And, you know, what you see here is this application of the Supreme Court's Second Amendment ruling last summer in Bruin, the New York case. It's like the next step. If you're, and what Judge Count is saying is, if we're supposed to look at the history and traditions of the United States for whether a gun regulation can stand, he's saying that he doesn't see anything about how in the past it looks like people accused or accused of domestic violence or under a protective order had their guns taken from them. He admitted he hadn't done a completely exhaustive search. I mean, this is a kind of problematic part of the whole idea that judges are going to be well equipped to do these kinds of deep dives into 18th and 19th century history. But, you know, in terms of a threat to public safety, all the things we would worry about in the modern world, people who have been accused of domestic violence and other things that lead to protective orders are not good bets to be carrying firearms in terms of risk, just real risk to people around them. And, you know, this is the implications of where the Supreme Court is going with the Second Amendment.
My chatter, two things. First of all, if you're in Washington, D.C. on November 30th, Wednesday, we're doing a live CityCast D.C. episode at Politics and Prose at Union Market. I'm going to be co-hosting it with Michael Schaefer, the host of CityCast D.C. So join us. It's going to be really fun. November 30th at 6:30 at Politics and Prose Union Market. You can meet the team behind CityCast, learn a lot about D.C. There are going to be drinks in the neighborhood afterwards. It's going to be really fun. I'd love to see you there at Politics and Prose on Union Market, November 30th. My actual chatter is about another crypto billionaire. I'm transfixed by another crypto billionaire, Michael Saylor. Michael Saylor is this interesting character who founded a data mining company called MicroStrategy way, way back in the 90s, made a ton of money with it, lost a ton of money. He lost more money in a single day than any person in history in the early 2000s. He lost $6 billion when MicroStrategy had to restate some earnings. And recently, he regained control of this company. The company was doing fine as this data mining company. He invested a huge percentage of the company in crypto. And so the company has now put billions of dollars of its assets into crypto. And those $4 billion have now shrunk to $2 billion. And that's very satisfying. But that's not why I'm interested. I'm interested because Michael Saylor is a Washingtonian. He lives in Washington. He's bought a bunch of Georgetown houses, tied them all together and to create a single mega mansion. He has a yacht that he docks in D.C. And he has not been paying D.C. taxes for years and apparently bragging about it. And now some whistleblowers have come along and said, this is a guy who claims he lives in Florida. He's actually living in D.C. Here's the goods. Here's the evidence that he's been in D.C. for more than 180 days or 185 days, whatever it is, in a given year. And he should pay his fair share of taxes. And he is being sued by D.C. There are tens of millions of dollars that he has not paid in D.C. taxes, according to these accusations. And it's just infuriating as a D.C. resident and D.C. citizen to think that this guy might be eluding taxes. I hate tax cheatery. It's really infuriating. And I hope that Michael Saylor, if he is guilty, is forced to disgorge tons of money so that D.C. can build better schools and parks and roads and things like that. Listeners, you also chatter. You tweet chatter to us at Slate Gabfest and you email them to us at gabfest@slate.com. And our listener chatter today comes from Kelly Mills.
Hi, Gabfest. This is Kelly Mills coming to you from Columbia, South Carolina. The Woman Who Smashed Codes, a true story of love, spies, and the unlikely heroine who outwitted America's enemies, authored by journalist Jason Fagone, is the most compelling nonfiction book I have ever read. Dubbed NPR's Best Book of the Year for 2017, the story of Elizabeth Smith Friedman, the mother of modern cryptography, does not disappoint in any arena. One look at the reviews will have you more than curious to learn about this heroine who sought no glory and in fact received very little due to the secret nature of her life's work. Give it a read or a listen. You won't regret it.
All right. Sounds great. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shayna Roth. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the big boss, the VP of audio of Slate. Please follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest. Tweet chatter to us there. And go to slate.com/conundrums and give us some great conundrums to talk about. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you on Thanksgiving next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? I'm a Thanksgiving obsessive. We've been doing the show for so long. Anyone who's listened to the Gabfest over the years knows that I talk and think about Thanksgiving a lot. So just bear with us. We're going to do a Slate Plus about Thanksgiving. In particular, what Thanksgiving traditions should be moved or eliminated? How can we fix or improve Thanksgiving, the perfect holiday? Can it be fixed or improved?
I would like to take issue with the premise at its start. Why are we futzing with it? It's in good shape.
It is. I have so many ideas.
All right, David, you start us off because you okay. think it's so wonderful. So I'm amazed that I know, you I'm can so... find things
okay.
to change.
It is so wonderful. It's so wonderful. It's the perfect holiday. Okay. I think the way that I'm not Christian, but I think that Christmas Eve is great. I think there should be a Thanksgiving Eve tradition that should be created and nationalized. I think there should be Wednesday night, there should be some big national concerts. Like that's the day that if we're going to do parades, you do the parade on Thanksgiving Eve. You do big sports events on Thanksgiving Eve. And then the day itself is itself, and you can still have some sports on it, whatever. That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.